Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Council. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams, Fish,
here.
Leonard,
here.
Saltzman, Potter,
here. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain, and please read items 1539 and 1540 together.
1539, adopt and implement the Skidmore Old Town Code Amendments and the Skidmore Old Town Historic District Design Guidelines. 1540, direct city bureaus to prioritize reuse of artifacts from the Earl Ladd and other cast iron artifact collections in the Skidmore Old Town Historic District.
Thank you. Would Gil Kelly, Carl Liesel, and Rick Michelson please come forward? We're going to have a staff presentation, approximately 15 minutes in length, and then there'll be some invited testimony, then we'll open it up to the public testimony. Gil?
Thanks, Mayor. Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. Gil Kelly, Director of Planning. With me are Carl Lyle, who is the Planning Bureau Project Manager for this effort, and Rick Michelson, who has been a consultant to the Bureau on this project. You'll recognize Rick from other activities. He has been both a member and chair, in fact, of the Planning Commission as well as the member of the Landmarks Commission in the past. He's no longer a member of either body. So he's working with us as a consultant on this project. I'm going to be very brief and turn it over to Carl. I will let you know that we, in general, try to bring things to you wrapped up in a bow, and this one is not. You, in fact, have two prominent city commissions coming to you, and they will testify as part of the invited testimony today with very different positions on the fundamental question here, which is whether or not to allow additional height and FAR, floor area ratio, on five so-called opportunity sites in the Ankeny-Skidmore Old Town area. So at the end of today's hearing, and you'll hear lots of testimony by a number of parties, we would like some indication from you as to any work you would like us to do between now and the time we return back to you. And depending on the nature and volume of testimony, we may want to suggest at the end of today's meeting that you leave that hearing open in case there are amendments or revisions that you'd like us to work on at the close of today's session. Suffice it to say that in addition to a split opinion between two of your advisory bodies, we have also heard very recently in writing from a number of prominent preservation groups, some of which are national in scope, and we have heard from a number of the members of the development community, and that testimony will be in front of you today. Again, you'll probably hear about a number of potential middle ground solutions on how much additional height and how much additional FAR and whether that should come exclusively from benefits accruing to the historic nature of the district, which is what the Planning Commission has proposed by transfers and a historic fund, or whether that should come from in some part or in whole part from housing bonuses. But that's really a second question. The first question is whether or not you suggest as a matter of policy that we do allow height and FAR on these five opportunity site. So with that sort of framework, I'm going to turn it over to Carl, and we're happy to answer any questions at the end of this or, if you prefer, at the end of testimony. Thanks.
Thanks, Gil. So what we'd like to do is Rick will actually give us a little background on the project and kind of how we got to this point. We'll talk about the actual pieces that are proposed, new design
can't
guidelines.
Can't let that one mistake bring down my day.
Where's the car?
All of these things happening.
Well, okay then.
What were you watching?
Just in case you didn't think the hearing was going to be entertaining enough on its own merits.
Right after the hip-hop hour, we'll do code changes, and then we'll talk about the proposed cast iron resolution. And then at the final sort of piece of the staff presentation, we'd like to give you a little bit more information on the controversial issues of the height opportunity sites, which we know you'll be hearing about in testimony.
Thank you. Let me just switch seats.
Sure.
Musical chairs.
I'll make it to the front row. Good afternoon. I'm Rick Michelson, and I've been the consultant helping our team, helping the Planning Bureau on this project. The work before you is one of the implementation measures that grew out of the Ankeny-Burnside study that was completed in 2006. It had a series of recommendations for revitalizing the district. Among them were finding a new location for Saturday Market, which is now under construction, funding certain catalytic projects in the district. Mercy Corps and White Stag Block have been funded. PDC's put about $20 million into helping to develop this district. The purpose of this project is to revise the regulatory framework and the design guidelines to make it easier for private developers to fill in the blanks, to begin to turn some of the parking lots into buildings, and to create a more vital character in the area. Our work on this project started just about a year ago in November. We had a series of workshops for the public, and we had a citizen working group that met with us three times. And since about June of this year, we've been working with the Landmarks Commission and the Planning Commission to help form their proposals and recommendations, which we're bringing to you today. Skidmore Old Town is very important. It's listed as a National Historic Landmark District in 1977, which means it really is of national value and interest. I think you've gotten some letters to that effect. It's where the city started, and it has an exceptional collection of Italianated cast iron buildings. 53% of the district is in contributing buildings, 18% is in non-contributing buildings, primarily buildings that were built a little after the period of significance, but still are relatively old, and 29% of the district is in surface parking. This shows what the district looked like in about 1930, before we had the demolitions for Harbor Drive and the infill parking and the parking lot developments in the district. By far, the Italianate building style was the predominant one, and these typically did have cast iron storefronts. And you'll hear people interchangeably talk about those cast iron buildings or Italianate buildings. By now, half of those Italianate buildings had been lost and reduced to parking lots, or our waterfront park took out some of them. So you can see that, how do you go backwards on this
thing? Use the arrows. Oh, hit escape.
So you can see quite clearly what's been lost in the district and why we're working so hard to fill in the blanks. The purpose of our project is to try to revitalize the district with new development while enhancing its historic character and protecting its historic buildings. I want to emphasize the protection of the historic buildings is of prime importance to everybody who's participated in this process. We've developed a five-piece strategy for doing this. First was to transfer the unused development capacity from the historic buildings elsewhere, to tailor the FAR bonuses to limit those to only those that really had a particular relationship to the historic character or housing in the neighborhood, rather than the whole list that is typically used throughout the city. I have a security patch upgrade coming on now. Okay. Then to give some ability to get added height and density on the edges of the district to promote development there. Use that development to help participate in the improvement of the rest of the district. We also needed to update the historic design guidelines to more accurately reflect the character of the district. And finally, we had a lot of discussion about our very valuable cast iron collection and seek ways to reuse that collection. In the proposed design guidelines, the existing guidelines were adopted in 1987. As you can see, they exist in a form that predates word processing. So they're not anyplace close to the present format and the present method of illustrations that we typically do in our design guidelines now. They also provide almost no guidance for new construction in the district. They were really developed at a time when renovating the existing buildings and making alterations were the prime issues. Proposed design guideline is about 87 pages long, but only a very small portion of it is being adopted as a regulatory procedure. The design guideline language themselves becomes the approval criteria for making decisions on designs in the district. The rest of the document is background, examples, things, ways to give advice to the development community to try to do the, make their projects fulfill the design guidelines. The first section of the design guidelines is the introduction, which clearly tells how to use the document, what its importance is, and where some of this stuff came from. I really want to call your attention to Chapter 2, which is the history and character of the district. This is a really good section. Nicholas Starin and Liza Mickle contributed to write this section, and it's well worth reading whether you're developing in the district or not. It gives you a real sense of why this area is so important. And the third chapter is the guidelines themselves. We've broken them up in four sections. One is general guidelines that apply to every project, a set for alterations, a set for additions, and a set for new construction, so people clearly know what they're talking about. We've done two interesting things in here. One is directed that additions that are bigger than the typical building in the district should use the new construction guidelines so they'll look like separate buildings. The other emphasis that the Landmarks Commission really made is on the Italianate character of the district. The feeling is that that's the prime character of the district, and we ought to be doing through the design guidelines, urging people to model their buildings or model their, be inspired by the cast iron buildings when developing new ones. The rest of this is the code changes, which Carl will go through.
So responding to the strategy slide that came up earlier and Rick kind of walked you through, we have a series of code changes that are intended to implement that strategy. One would be allowing FAR, or floor area ratio, transfers within the district from any contributing buildings in the district. Currently, they are allowed from historic landmark properties, but the majority of the historic properties within the historic district are not landmark properties. They're contributing structures. So that would be a new tool available to those structures. And we would be able to transfer them from those red structures in this map to the blue structures or blue sites. Those are sites without contributing structures still within the district. We didn't want to send this outside the district because this project was so focused on just that district boundary. And we also believe that sending much of the unused development potential outside the district actually won't help us get to the goal of a more vibrant, livelier district in the long run. And we actually need to keep some of that development potential within the district. So that's one tool. Another is recrafting the FAR bonus system within the district, creating a new district improvement fund FAR bonus for use within the historic district. Developers could pay into that fund to access bonus FAR. Maintaining the housing bonuses as they currently are for use below 75 feet, and we're coming to that nuance in a moment, and then eliminating the other FAR bonuses that currently might apply in the district, and there's a whole list of them. Depending on how you count, there's 18 or so. Not all are available within the Skidmore district, but many of them are. The point of that move is to try and target the use of that good tool, one of the few tools we really have through zoning, which is the bonus FAR, to mechanisms that clearly benefit the historic character of the district. So the fund that can be used for historic projects within the district, and then the transfer, which is the next piece. And so actually, it's not the next piece; it's the additional height in FAR. So this is the controversial piece that we're going to hear about from probably 90% of the people testifying today. And this is the idea that within the district, there may be some sites, there are some sites, five sites particularly, at the edge of the district that are surface parking lots or non-contributing structures where additional height in FAR could go. And that could serve both as an incentive and sort of an enticement to get development interest up on those blocks and also to improve development feasibility, but also if it's linked to a transfer program or linked to the bonus fund program, it can be a way to improve the whole district and help fund other projects within the district. So the proposal is to single out those five sites that are in yellow and to suggest that above 75 feet and up to 130 feet on four of them and up to 100 feet on one, the FAR above 75 feet can be used, but only if it's from transferred historic buildings in the district or purchased from the District Improvement Fund. So that is the proposal. And then the cast iron resolution, which is a separate agenda item that we're discussing together, really came from Landmarks Commission, and where we were trying to figure out a way to reuse cast iron within the district and encourage its reuse. We have Skidmore Old Town's cast iron buildings are one of the finest collections in the nation, certainly on the West Coast. And as Rick Michelson said, we're talking about the sort of high Victorian style Italianate structures with the arches and all the cast iron elements. Many cast iron artifacts were rescued during the demolition period. We and actually PDC and Bosco Milligan Foundation have control over quite a large collection of several hundred artifacts. There's a much interest to in trying to get them reused within the district. Some have been in Ankeny Plaza, if you're familiar with some of the cast iron archways that are there. But there's a lot more that could be done, and there's a real interest in trying to see if whole facades could be rebuilt on some of the surface parking lots as they redevelop with using the cast iron elements. So what specifically is proposed in the resolution is that it would require all reasonable efforts be made to include cast iron artifacts in city redevelopment projects and any projects that cities, that the city is or its offices are participating in financially. So that's essentially what that resolution would require. And the fund, of course, going back to the fund, could be used to help help make those project work if we did the district improvement fund.
Would city financial participation include a tax abatement?
You know, I think it could. Yeah, we could clarify that.
It's not proposed as part of this package, but that's something that we could look at. Yeah.
So this packet anticipates a financial contribution as opposed to an abatement tool?
Well, no. This is saying if the city is going to do a project of its own in the district, for example, it could do that. Carl was also referring to the fund. Should you allow for higher heights, and the way to get the higher heights or FAR would be in part at least to buy into a historic preservation fund, then that fund, which might be administered by the city, for example, could be used as well.
This is also really targeted towards new construction on the surface parking lots, which wouldn't typically be eligible for the historic tax abatement, but you know, it could be a tool we would use in the future for new development within the district, potentially. And then, so this is the section where I wanted to highlight a few of the things that we're going to hear a lot about, and those are the controversial issues regarding these edge opportunity sites, the places where we suggest you could, at the edge of the district, you could build additional height. So height is the first thing, and as Gil said, that's really the first question to council in terms of direction that we need. If you want to pursue this idea, then there are some other questions to look at. If you don't, then many of these other questions kind of go away.
So, I ask a question about the edge opportunity site. Are these the definition of it, or are those the characteristics you want to provide to those areas?
It's five specific sites that are mapped out that we'll see in a minute in 3D to sort of get a good sense of where they
are. How do you define that? Is that a...
So how do we select the sites?
How are they designated edge opportunity sites?
They're actually sites. They are parcels or half blocks. Actually, most of them are half blocks that are mapped on a zoning code map. So you either have one of those sites that you're proposing to develop or you don't. And they were selected by looking at all the redevelopment sites in the district and doing some 3D modeling and making this coming to the conclusion that on many of those redevelopment sites in the core of the district, height above 75 feet would absolutely be detrimental.
Let me answer it in a slightly different way if I could, Mayor. This would not be left to interpretation. Your action, should you decide to pursue this direction, would actually include the map designation. So there would be five and no more, and that map would be an official part of your action so that it wouldn't be left to interpretation about what sites we were talking about in the future.
Thank you.
Additional FAR, which is currently proposed to be allowed on four of the five opportunity sites that would go with the height. Residential bonus use above 75 feet. As I said, we've left it in place for use below 75 feet within the district, but not allowed it as for use above. Conflicts between the guidelines and the zoning code. So these two pieces, the zoning code coming to you as recommended from the Planning Commission, the design guidelines coming to you as recommended from the Landmarks Commission. As Gil said, those commissions basically fundamentally in disagreement about the height opportunity sites. So if, you know, however we end up going on this, we may need to go back and make sure that they're a little bit more compatible or consistent at least. And then this last bullet is implications to the National Historic Landmark status. We received a letter from the National Park Service on Monday afternoon that came as a little bit of a surprise to us, but essentially said that they're uncomfortable with this idea of additional height and that they would want to work with us to see, you know, what that really meant and make sure that it wasn't going to be a potential limitation to the status of the district as a national landmark, which we take very seriously, and no one wants it to be, you know, not a national landmark anymore. So that is a new kind of a follow-up piece that if you wanted to continue with this this approach of looking at height, we would need to follow up with that. So on the height, we've got a series of 3D model views that help kind of understand what exactly is proposed and how they fit within the district. So this is the district as built today in the 3D model. The brown buildings are the historic structures. The outline of the historic district boundary is on this map as well. You can see the fire station right there in the middle. And the surface parking lots are also clear. Now, this is within the existing entitlement envelopes, so existing height limits in the district. You see all those orange boxes are essentially building up the surface parking lots within the district. And as Rick said, there's 29% of the district is surface parking lots, so it's quite a bit, built up to the 75-foot height limit and lot lines. So you see those within the district. Outside the district, you see shadowed in the height envelopes of sort of the rest of downtown. And so you see 460-foot height limits and 350-foot height limits and things much larger than the 75 feet, basically immediately outside the district. And then the addition of the red boxes, the five red boxes, those are the additional height envelopes essentially that are proposed by this zoning project. So on those five sites, this zoning package would allow, through using the transfer, for using the district improvement fund, would allow those sites to build up to 130 feet at or near the edges of the district.
Is that all of them or four of them and one is only up to 100 feet?
That is all five of them. One is to 100 feet. So the one in the top middle is in Chinatown. And as you see, the shadowed in box sort of immediately to the left of it in Chinatown, right here. The reason Planning Commission wanted us to hold that site to 100 feet, and I'm sure you'll hear testimony about that today, was that it's both in the Skidmore Old Town Historic District, but also within the Chinatown, New Japantown Historic District. And the height limit in the adjacent part of that district is 100 feet. So we were uncomfortable without looking into the height limits and the rationale behind 100-foot height limits in Chinatown with exceeding that limit.
But what's
in the case
the height
site
of the natural gas building across the street from the middle? Yeah, right there.
That's 180 feet. It's about 180-foot building. It's half inside the district and half outside the district. And these two sites on the northern edge are proposed to be 130 feet. This one in Chinatown, 100 feet, and these two southern sites, 130 feet. And then we have a few other views using the 3D model. So looking from the Burnside Bridge, this is the district as built today with the brown historic buildings. There you see the gas building. The district as built under current entitlements with the 75-foot height envelopes in the district and the taller ones outside. And then with the addition of the red boxes, which represent the additional height proposed through the zoning package. And then we've got a few views from street level. So looking north on Northwest First from just after you come out from underneath the Burnside Bridge, a photograph there. And then this is the 3D model view of that with you see the gas building sort of peeking up over one of the historic buildings in the district. And then with the entitlements as currently allowed outside the district and inside at 75 feet, and then with the additional red above. So that's one view. And then we have another view looking south on Southwest 2nd Avenue. So this is south from Ankeny Street, basically, where the street makes the jog. This is the photo view. And then we have the district that's currently built with the brown historic buildings. And then the district with current entitlements. So these are the 75-foot envelopes inside the district and the much, much taller ones of downtown immediately outside. And then with the proposed additional height above those two opportunity sites on 2nd. And then back to the district overview. So that's kind of how they fit in. A similar kind of a look was done at all the surface parking lots, as I mentioned, to pick these five. It was clearly additional height, which had been proposed through part of the Ankeny-Burnside development process for all the sites in the district as a way to encourage development, was pretty rapidly dismissed as something we didn't want to do. But on these five edge opportunity sites, we thought there was some potential to pursue it. Another issue is how much FAR to allow on these opportunity sites. The height limits are going up, so should the FAR go up too? That's kind of the question. If you leave it at 7-1, which is the maximum that you could get to currently anywhere in the district at a 4-to-1 base and then 3-to-1 through bonuses or transfers. There's actually quite a bit of room to play around with the upper sort of massing of the building, which was the key thing that the Planning Commission wanted us to make sure that there was enough room to be able to sculpt the building and move the mass around and achieve some step backs at appropriate heights. So at 7-to-1, there's a lot. They kind of pushed those down through the analysis, and Rick did these, and Lloyd Lindley did these sketches to sort of show, given one particular set of assumptions for a building, if you push those down to sort of the absolute minimum that we might be comfortable with in terms of step backs, you get just a little over 8. And then at 9-to-1, clearly there's not enough left. You're just going to fill the entire envelope right up to 130 feet, and that was something Planning Commission felt strongly that we wanted to avoid. So that's why the Planning Commission recommendation is for a maximum of 8-to-1 on four of the sites that have 130 feet height limits, and on the one that was held to 100 because of its situation in Chinatown, they wanted to stay with 7-to-1 for exactly the same reason, because the height limit's lower, you'd fill it more quickly. And at more than 7-to-1, they didn't feel like there was enough room at 100 feet for adequate step backs and flexibility. So the residential bonus above 75 feet, we'll hear about that. Currently, like I said, FAR above 75 feet on those height opportunity sites would only be allowed through the historic transfer or payment into the district improvement fund. You're going to hear people suggesting that we should allow the residential bonus to also be used above 75 feet. We can consider that. The reason that we didn't want to do that is we're trying to tie as closely as possible the benefit of the larger buildings at the edge of the district to the historic preservation goals of the whole district, and we felt that those two tools made that that connection most clear. There's also one other piece to mention here, that's that to get from 7-to-1 to 8-to-1 on those four sites that we talked about, at least 1-to-1 must come from the historic transfer, and that's a positive benefit for the district in terms of it coming from a historic building, and thereby helping preserve that building, but also it has a transportation relationship to not wanting to increase the overall amount of development potential within the district without getting into transportation studies. So that's what that's about. And then finally, on the conflict between design guidelines, if we pursue the idea of extra height on these edge opportunity sites, we need to go back to the design guidelines and have another look at them and propose some edits. If we choose not to follow the pursue the additional height, then the guidelines are probably fine. So what we'd like you to do today is listen to all this testimony. Consider the issues that I just highlighted. And there they are again. And then give us some specific direction, as Gil said, about what you'd like us to do in terms of follow-up. And then, if there is follow-up and it's pretty clear that's where we want to go, we should probably continue this hearing and set a time certain date a month or so out to consider amendments.
If there are no questions of staff at this point, we do have some invited testimony, Mayor, that we would suggest. I don't know if you have that list in front of you.
I do.
Okay.
Bill, can we take a few questions, Mayor, or would you prefer to wait?
No, go ahead.
First of all, thank you for the presentation, and particularly the visual piece. It's very helpful to see what this might look like. Gil, one of the arguments, or maybe the prime argument for the additional height and FAR, is that it would serve as a catalyst for development. And excuse my voice. I think I have what has struck Sam as well. So what evidence do we have in the record that this would, in fact, be a catalyst for development?
Yeah. Well, I think this notion goes back to the Ankeny Skidmore plan document that both Rick and Carl referred to, which was a plan done between planning and PDC a couple of years ago, at least now. And through those discussions, it was clear that with the urban renewal district retiring in that part of town, and with some good projects and some momentum underway in terms of investments that had been committed at that point, including the University of Oregon, Mercy Corps, and others, the waterfront park, farmers market, and so forth, Saturday market, excuse me, that momentum ought to continue, and that probably a range of things would be needed for private development to continue that momentum on its own. This is, of course, before the recent financial crisis. One of those would be relaxation of the height restrictions that was felt by that committee at the time. And so this is pursuing that notion. The Planning Commission did hear testimony from the development community. In fact, they were presented with, at least in one case, a project pro forma analysis that showed the additional height and floor area ratio would make that project workable. Now, every project is unique, and you can challenge any of the assumptions in a pro forma, including the basis in the land itself and so forth and so on. But the Planning Commission did receive testimony on that. We, as part of the planning project here, we have not done an in-depth additional work on the financial aspects. We did ask Rick to look at that, who has a development background and may want to add on to my answer here. Suffice it to say, we sort of came down on, yes, it would be helpful. It's probably by itself not sufficient to make projects work or not work. There are a number of other factors that play into that.
And I think one of the reasons that, as Carl mentioned before, we're linking this increased density to the Historic Improvement Fund is so that there will be some direct payoff from these larger projects to do other things in the district through that funding mechanism.
No, I understand that, but, I mean, if we increase the height and FAR, I mean, we're increasing the value of this land. But yep. The premise is so that it's supposed to induce some kind of activity. And do you have a forecast that within the next X number of years?
Yeah, it's really hard to do that. And we always caution the Planning Commission against sort of making judgments about the physical form of the city based on the economics of a project today or tomorrow. We can sort of take a rough guess at what might be helpful, which is what we've done here. The other factor, of course, at play in the district is that most of these sites, I think four of the five of them, are surface parking lots, which are very safe investment, big revenue generators, low risk, and something is probably needed that's equally or more compelling to convert those uses.
So, Gil, could you also comment? We have a prominent developer submitted a letter in our packet that argues that property owners that are using the vacant land for parking garages are actually going to make more money maintaining them as parking garages than developing the land. Have you looked at that question?
Well, I think they're parking lots, not parking garages, lots, first of all. Secondly, no, I'm not sure I've read that letter, but I think the argument was made perhaps by that same person during the Planning Commission hearings, and that is that it may not be an effect on the parking rates or parking revenues per se, but the value of their land will increase by this, and that doesn't necessarily translate into developing. In fact, as some have argued, that it will cause some of the landowners to wait longer to develop than the current height limits because they'll wait for the market to catch up to those larger building envelopes. We clearly heard that disputed from the other side, from the developer side of the table.
You know, the Landmarks Commission letter sort of goes the opposite direction.
Yes.
And it says that there's been no demonstration that with new construction designs that would promote development. Asking the question, looking back over the last 10 years, what has been the major development? Has it been the taller buildings or taking the historic buildings and maintaining them and building them out like, for instance, the University of Oregon did?
Yeah, in general, there has not been a lot of development, period, in the district. That's the first thing to understand. What has been done has largely been, as you've described, taking the lower building profile and either rehabilitating existing historic buildings or, in one case with Mercy Corps, adding on to that at a similar scale. One thing that came up in the testimony to Planning Commission over and over again is that those were largely done with public subsidy, and the public subsidy is pretty scarce now, particularly with the Urban Renewal District expiring. And I think that's what helped the Planning Commission sort of decide, you know, maybe we ought to take a risk on some larger envelopes here because those projects will largely be on their own going forward without public subsidy.
So that is that the driving force behind this? Because in the letter that the Planning Commission sent out, they said that it was all about the Planning Commission stresses that the relationship of floor area to height is critical in this conclusion. And their conclusion is that this needs to happen. And you're saying that it's about trying to attract development.
Well, I think they, in the first case, they were, or primarily they felt it was a reasonable risk and a benefit to the district overall to allow some bigger buildings on these few sites to help energize the district, because they felt there was some compelling evidence that this would help with new development projects to increase the height in FAR. What their caution was about in that phrase you wrote was, as Carl tried to describe with those pictures, not capping the height at 130, but then filling it all up with maximum FAR gives you no ability left to sort of sculpt those buildings and have the upper floors step back, for example, to allow the base of the building to read more like the historic scale in the district. So that was their caution, is don't lard up the FAR or you kind of you lose the compatibility with the existing district in the bargain. But I think they were pretty clear. I think it was a unanimous vote at the Planning Commission that they felt that on these five sites that you should go ahead and raise the height and FAR limits. And we do have three commissioners here to testify themselves.
Just to follow up on that, we have letters from the United States Department of the Interior and from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. You said that one or both came in fairly late in the game. Have you done a preliminary assessment as to whether the code changes that are being proposed would, in fact, imperil our National Historic designation?
There's not a bright-line test, so we take this letter very seriously. And as Carl described, we're going to want to talk with that with them after this meeting. Carl at least has had one meeting, one conversation already.
So we got the letter on Monday afternoon. We got the letter on Monday afternoon, and we had a conference call with staff from the National Park Service who wrote that letter this morning. Yeah, this morning, to sort of try and get a better understanding of that. And they clearly are concerned about the proposal of extra height. I'm not entirely sure that they understand the full package of both code proposals and the role of the design guidelines and our approvals process. So I think it's clear that they're open for discussion with us, but that they go into that discussion with some reservations about the extra height.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay. We're going to call up from the Landmarks Commission, Brian Emmerich and Carrie Richter. And from the Planning Commissioners, we'll hear from Michelle Rood, Howard Shapiro, and Andre Baugh. From the Portland Development Commission, Lou Bowers, from the Old Town and Chinatown Neighborhood Association and Visions Joint Land, Patrick Gortmeyer, and Paul Burrio. So we'll start with you folks.
Thank you. My name is Carrie Richter. I'm the Vice Chair of the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission, and with me today is Brian Emmerich, a member of the PHLC as well. As you know, the Historic Landmarks Commission's mission is to provide leadership and expertise on maintaining and enhancing Portland's historic and architectural heritage that is mandated by our city code. Our Landmarks Commission is pleased to forward to you the Skidmore Old Town Historic Design Guidelines for approval. We are proud of the collaborative effort and spirited debate that went into the creation of this important document, including discussions with the neighborhood, community, and various city agencies. The guidelines powerfully fulfill two missions. First, they give clear direction regarding design, scale, materials, and proportions that will best guide applicants, eliminating the ambiguity of the previous 1984 design guideline set. Second, they provide a strong economic development tool by establishing a high standard of congruent historic design that ensures the vision of the whole district is strengthened over time. These guidelines are consistent with what is was envisioned by the Ankeny-Burnside Framework Plan in that they, quote, showcase the district's unique character and preserve the character-defining elements through the use of cast iron.
Good afternoon. I'm Brian Emmerich, and I'm an architect on the Landmarks Commission. I'm going to talk to you just briefly about the Landmarks findings on Skidmore Old Town and why the cast iron is architecturally significant. The Skidmore Old Town Historic District is where the city of Portland began. It's truly one of the most special places in our city, featuring signature works of architecture, the Skidmore Fountain, and unique streets not found anywhere else in the city. In order to acknowledge, celebrate, and protect its collection of cast iron buildings, the district was listed in the National Register of Historic Places in 1975 and designated a National Historic Landmark in 1977 by the U.S. Department of the Interior. It's one of only two such designated landmarks in the city of Portland and the only one that encompasses the scale of an entire neighborhood. We believe that the Skidmore Old Town Historic District can become a key cultural attraction to the region, showcasing its one-of-a-kind collection of Italianate cast iron architecture and telling the story of our city. These guidelines provide the framework for that to happen. The sheer size of our collection of cast iron era buildings is among the largest in the United States, and it's an enduring monument to the importance of Portland as a center of influence for the development of the Pacific Northwest. The era of building signified Portland's transformation from a frontier outpost to a world-class city. Names of our early leaders we still recognize today are memorialized here in the city they built to support their engines of empire. These local fortunes later became the heritage of the city as our merchants and investors dominated the Pacific Northwest for the next half century. Architecturally, what makes this district unique is the widespread use of cast iron in the primary building facades. The advent of cast iron signaled a new era in architecture that coincided with Portland's rise to power. Stronger than masonry construction, cast iron allows for more transparent, lighter-feeling facades, which were especially employed on the ground floors of the buildings. Being essentially a precast kit of parts, it also made elaborate details and transportation to job sites more economical for buildings of this era. Though half the buildings in the district were demolished, the district amazingly is still among the largest collection of cast iron in the nation. As the other major iron city, San Francisco, was destroyed by the Great Earthquake in 1906. Through the aid of a few visionary citizens, many parts of the buildings were salvaged and stored for an uncertain future. Now they provide a phenomenal pattern library to bring some of these well-documented structures back to life from the kit of parts they were once again reduced to. Known as the Eric Ladd Cast Iron Collection, it has been purchased by the city with the mandate to benefit the public in the highest, best use. This place is of singular importance to our city and nation and makes its preservation, protection, and enhancement a key priority for our commission and the city we represent. The guidelines we have created not only work to protect the key elements of the district, but are extremely progressive in that they work to actually bring back the character of the district through thoughtful development of the vacant sites that contribute to the whole. They encourage the reuse of an amazing resource the city possesses, the Eric Ladd Cast Iron Collection.
In closing, we know that our design guidelines don't discuss the five opportunity sites, but we would like to talk a little bit about the Landmarks Commission position on that proposal. I know that staff has suggested that the guidelines would need to be revised if the five opportunity sites were the additional height is approved. I think that that is incorrect. The guidelines do not prohibit the height. They require compatibility in design and, in fact, I think could be accommodated theoretically under the existing guidelines. We feel that the scale of the structures and the proposed economic benefit they bring to the district is far outweighed by the potential damage they inflict. The character of the entire district is what makes it valuable both aesthetically and economically. And one of the key defining features is the small urban scale and pedestrian environment currently maintained in the district. Brian provided some color photographs that I would like for you to take a look at. They show two of the proposed opportunity sites and a historic building contributing structure next to the forestry building. And what's key about this photo is it shows the forestry building is 130 feet, so that gives you a sense of what these smaller three- and four-story historic structures will look like when they're enveloped by these taller, quote-unquote, opportunity sites. In addition to detracting from the character of the district, these opportunity sites are unlikely to provide the economic stimulus the neighborhood seeks. They are on the edge of the district and will not rise to the level of economic stimulus and vibrancy that a collective vision based on guidelines provides. The Landmarks Commission recognizes that there are numerous sites for potential redevelopment in the district, sites currently used for surface parking. That presents challenges to the district's continuity and character. However, the Commission believes that the city's first duty is to do no harm to the character of the historic district and to preserve and enhance the quality of the district's historic structures and scale. The vitality and future success of this neighborhood is directly related to reinforcement of a cohesive historic identity and not in blurring the perception of the district. Rezoning the property now is inconsistent with what was envisioned in the Burnside-Ankeny plan, which says, quote, when updating the central city plan, the city should explore transfer of development rights as a means to protect and enhance the character of the district. This suggests to me that it should occur when updating the central city plan, which the city is in the process of doing. Another reason to delay is that we don't know yet how significant the redevelopment of the current buildings in the area will work to ignite and energize redevelopment in the area. We don't know what the University of Oregon redevelopment project will bring. We don't know what Mercy Corps and moving Saturday Market will bring. We ought to give it some time to figure that out or to realize those benefits. Further, delaying any decision about height and density into the central city plan will allow for a coordinated look at height as it relates to development incentives citywide, as well as to provide time and the opportunity for the various review boards, the Planning Commission, the Design Review Commission, and the Historic Landmarks Commission, to come up with a coordinated and cohesive response to this situation. Rather than simply plunking down five opportunity sites, the Commission asks that you respect the guidelines, adopting them as written, and table the height restrictions and opportunity site discussion for inclusion in the Central City Plan. Thank you.
You know, I wanted to ask you the same question that, were you going to ask it, Nick?
Please, Mayor.
That was asked of the Planning Commission about why this would create opportunity for economic development by maintaining the historic character and scale, as opposed to what the recommendations are for the opportunity sites. You know, obviously, the Planning Commission had a different take on what constitutes or what would generate economic development. How do you folks view economic development in terms of retaining the historical?
Well, I think the I think that the Skidmore Old Town Historic District is a singular place, and we are trying to strengthen that with the guidelines so that when you actually step into that district, there is a feeling that you've arrived somewhere, and it's half there right now. And that's actually the value of the district, is that it is a unique place, and strengthening those historic values of the buildings there and the scale, and it's actually a smaller building pattern there. Most of the lots were smaller. It's a little bit more of an organic grassroots kind of building pattern, frankly, and that has a unique character to it, and that actually is what brings the value to the district, we would argue.
But I'm struggling to understand how these five sites that are built on the periphery of the district impact the sense that you're describing.
Well, I think you can see in the first exhibit that Carrie pointed out with the forestry building, one of the five sites actually is directly behind McCormick and Schmick's in this. And you can see there's, I think this is actually a positive thing right now. The boundaries of the district are delineated by large buildings, and generally scale is one of the most defining features of the Old Town District. If we start eroding that scale by pulling buildings inside of the district that are similar in height, I think you start losing the boundaries in the sense of the edge of the district, and therefore you're basically shrinking the district in the sense of the district.
I'm just wondering if some of that might be confused with the look of that particular building, if a building was designed more appropriate to the district, which I would argue that federal building is not.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change any of that?
Well, I certainly think that helps, and I think that's one of the areas for further exploration is, you know, whether there's, you know, perhaps the five opportunity sites somewhat more of a compromise there. You know, you heard Carl talk about different FARs and how much opportunity that allows for step backs. I mean, certainly that affects the perception from the ground level, but at some point, I think it's awfully hard to hide a 130-foot tall building, you know, no matter what you do to make it look nice at, you know, the four-story level. At some point, it's the size that it is. Most of these sites are half-block sites, so, you know, that forestry building, when you're looking at it there, is actually you're seeing a half-block look at that, and that's similar in scale to what you would see with these newer developments that they're proposing.
If I could follow up on that, Commissioner. This is for either Carrie or Brian. The design guidelines appear to limit the type of materials that can be used on building exteriors to stone or brick. Some of the property owners who've appealed to us have proposed that they be allowed to use, quote, appropriate metal finishes. And I'd like to ask you whether you view metal finishes of any kind as appropriate within a National Historic District.
Well, I don't think that's true that they limit it to stone and brick. Actually, one of the primary things we're trying to encourage is the reuse of cast iron, which is indeed, you know, metal. What we're trying to do is, with the guidelines, is actually, though, rather than in the past and in the 1987 guidelines, new buildings or additions to buildings were thought of as try to do no harm with that building. It's kind of a bland, blend-in building and let the others shine. Recognizing that we have so many missing teeth in the district, half the buildings are missing. Our approach was a little bit more progressive and proactive in that we're trying to draw inspiration from the original character-defining cast iron buildings. Not that they're going to be replicas, though we're talking about perhaps being able to rebuild some of them with the cast iron collection, the Eric-Ladd collection. But new buildings would clearly be built in a manner that's consistent and compatible with the existing buildings. But it doesn't rule out metal finishes.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Carrie, you said that you view the proposal on the opportunity sites as unlikely to create the economic stimulus that sort of prompted this proposal. I asked Gil a similar question about what evidence is there that this will serve as a catalyst, and what kind of prediction could he make? And he cautioned against that. Let me ask you the reverse question. Why do you think it's unlikely that this will create any kind of economic stimulus?
Because it's on the edge. It's not in the center. It's not going to incite development in the center. What we really want to create is a historic district that is cast iron replications or cast iron design that sort of starts at Skidmore Fountain and goes out. And and that's what sort of University of Oregon does. That's what Mercy Corps does. That's what Saturday Market's going to do. That's where the people are going to be. And we want a place where people come and they look around and they see something different and they want to learn more. And if these opportunity sites are built at a higher height, you don't look around and say there's something unique here and there's something special here. And that's why I'm not a developer, I'm a lawyer. So I'm sure there will be people who can answer that question better than I can from an economic standpoint.
But how does the Northwest Natural Gas building not have that effect currently?
It does. It does.
So how do you rationalize that that's happened, but on properties similarly located on the edge of the district, we're not going to do that?
I'm sorry. Were you asking, though, that whether the natural gas building contributes in the way that these new buildings are?
I mean, in the current state of the district, you have the Northwest Natural Gas building. And I'm asking, how does that not create the negative impact on the feel of the district? And you said that it does. And so... but then how, for consistency's sake, given that that's on the edge of the district, do we not allow the same kind of thing on the edge of the district? I mean, I'm supposing that the reason that that was allowed at the time that it was allowed is that it's not in the district but on the edge of the district. So.
Right. Well, I think what you do is you bring that boundary in tighter. If you develop, obviously the natural gas building does exist on the edge of the district, and you effectively shrink the district. If, say, we replicated, I know that building is not a great example design-wise, but if we replicated that building, bringing it in closer, you know, there's two opportunity sites directly across the street from the natural gas building. Those are two of the proposed sites, and essentially you shrink the district by bringing that closer in, I would say.
I think the natural gas building right now is a boundary, because you look at that and you say, you're not in the district there, but when you stand around the other side of the street, you feel like you are in the district, and there's no reason to erode the district further, as Brian mentioned.
And I would also say that the natural gas building and the forestry building, indeed, are good examples of there's not a feeling around those buildings that the district's been revitalized. There's not a lot going on around the base of the natural gas
building. Is that because of the height or because of the design?
I would argue it's a little bit of both. I think the height's a little bit of an alienating factor from a pedestrian scale standpoint, but there's not a lot of, you know, retail activity going on the ground floor either. So,
if I could add one more component to this, I think that the opposite, Commissioner Fish, the opposite at all is also true. What evidence have we seen that a building at 130 feet can be designed to be compatible? And I don't think that evidence is before us. On the flip side of that coin, if a 130-foot building will be an incentive and will ignite the district, you're assuming it can be made compatible because the forestry building is not, or the gas building is not. I would suggest, and one of the issues that I made an issue during the Landmarks Commission was that we need to see the compatible building at 130 feet.
Don't you have an insurance policy on that, though, and the fact they would come before design?
Well, right, and that's why the guidelines are written the way they are, is so that we would have the opportunity to review these buildings. But I think that the planning committee or the Landmarks Commission would have had more comfort had we had a building in front of us that we could have viewed and said, okay, I see it can be done.
So I'd like you to put a different hat on for a second,
sure,
because I understand the position of the organization, and I also understand what your mission is in terms of preservation. But of the five sites, are there any sites that you find more objectionable than others?
Personally, and I'm just speaking on my own, I would say the two southern sites are more objectionable. They're closer within what feels more like the heart of the district. As Randy mentioned, we've got the natural gas building and the city parking lot on the north edge of the district. That's my personal sense is those would do less damage, but I think that, you know, in a perfect world, none of those necessarily benefit the district architecturally if they're developed out to the 130 feet.
You know, I should have asked the Planning Commission this, I mean the Planning Bureau, but do you know when they said that they would have to rewrite portions of the new guidelines, that what that means in terms of if we were to approve the five sites, and they said they'd have to come back and revisit the actual guidelines?
Well, I think what they're speaking to, and there's probably some different levels of interpretation on that, Mr. Mayor, is that you know, the guidelines are really written with the entire district in mind, which is 20 blocks, and the five opportunity sites really only comprise a little over two blocks. So we're talking about, you know, the guidelines are really written for the 90%. If we're going to talk about, you know, these special sites, there's probably, rather than diluting down the entire guidelines document, which really is applying to the district, there probably needs to be an appendix or some sort of a special section in there that would address how we might want to see these sites developed, and, you know, with step backs or whatever mechanisms that we can to try to ensure compatibility as much as we can there, and use those as spot zone sites, essentially, so that we talk about them separately without diluting down the entire framework of the guidelines.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
On the Planning Commission, we'll have Michelle Rudd, Howard Shapiro, and Andre Ball. Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record.
Michelle Rudd with the Planning Commission, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We join with the Landmark Commission in appreciating the jewel that this area is. One of the joys of serving on the Planning Commission is I think it gives all of us the opportunity to learn more about just the pockets of wonderful within the city and the assets that we have. And so the challenge for us and what we heard listening to all the testimony was how to best help this area reach its potential, both protecting the historic resource and providing the energy and vitality that the community and the city as a whole is looking for in this location. When we looked at this, and it was a lot of discussion and a lot of balancing of how do we find a way to make these sites these opportunity sites if we go up in the FAR and the height compatible with the historic nature of the district. I think some of the focus of the